I'm Michael Keegan with the Coalition for Nuclear Free Great Lakes, and it is my honor to present Dr. Arjun Makajani will be presenting The Way Forward Without Nukes. Arjun Makajani is president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research in Tacoma Park, Maryland, with a PhD specializing in nuclear fusion. Dr. Makajani is a recognized authority on energy issues. Since 1971, he has published numerous articles, reports, and books on energy and the environment, including Carbon-Free and Nuclear-Free, A Roadmap for U.S. Energy Policy, that was in 2007. Dr. Makajani has testified before Congress and served as a consultant to several state utilities and UN agencies.
Well, thank you, Michael. I'm very pleased to be here. Being in a famous university reminds me of the time I was a student in the University of Bombay, and I wanted to come here for graduate school, and I applied to many famous places. I don't think I applied to the University of Chicago. Was it not famous in 1965? No, sorry. No, I didn't know about that reactor when I was applying to graduate school. And then I thought it'd be nice to go to school in the capital of the United States, and I applied to Washington State University. And they gave me this wonderful assistantship, and I said yes, and I found I was 3,000 miles off. And anyway, I went, it was good. And then I did my doctorate in California, and that was even better. How many of you recognize the guy on the left, on your left? Oh, this is a very good audience, more than average. David Freeman, father of energy policy in this country, in my opinion. 5 years ago, he made a speech at a conference. You recognize the woman on the right, yes. Helen Caldicott. And Helen had a conference on energy in 2006, about 6.5 years ago. And Dave and I were both speaking there, and Dave made a speech in which he said we should get rid of nuclear and we should get rid of coal and we should get rid of oil and go to solar. So in 2006. And solar was about $8 a watt at that time. It was very expensive. And I went up to him and I said, you're going to send every industry we have left to China. You know, this is not a, you haven't said something that sounds sensible to me. And he said, well, don't be a, well, he uses more salty language than I do. And anyway, he said, don't be a naysayer. You haven't done the technical study. And it's true that I've been working on nuclear disarmament for many years and the pollution caused by nuclear weapons production and some on energy, but since the mid-80s, I hadn't done a whole lot of work on energy. And Helen said, you know, the planet is in intensive care, and I'll show you only one slide about that. This is the most important thing that we could be working on. If you do the study, I'll raise the money. And this is, of course, an offer that no one who runs a nonprofit can refuse. And so I said, okay, but I don't promise you a positive answer that it's possible to do this in a reasonable time and reasonable cost. You know, if you have unlimited money, you can do it. But and so I went into doing this book, Carbon-Free, Nuclear-Free, and the title really did come after I finished my research. I didn't start with this idea. I started only to look at whether it was feasible technically with the technologies that either we had in hand or technologies that we had in hand whose costs we could see reasonably in the next 10 years. So this isn't predicting what will happen, which I hope will be more efficient and better than what I calculated, but I concluded at the end of a year's research that, to my own surprise, that you could actually get rid of fossil fuels, not just in the electricity sector, but from the whole energy sector, if we were only willing to have some guts and be sensible. And tomorrow you will hear the German story about that, which is, I think, going to be probably the first major country to make that come true. But when I wrote this, this was kind of sticking my neck pretty far out in 2007. So we don't have one energy problem. We have four energy problems. Well, we used to have three until Washington got involved. And now we have four. So we have, of course, the climate problem. Then we have the oil and war problem, or the oil insecurity problem. The 20th century has really been, to a large extent, a century of war for oil, one side of it anyway. Then we've got the nuclear insecurity problem and all the water problems and other things that go with it. And now, you know, since Washington got involved with the food and corn into ethanol mandates, now we've got a food problem associated with the, supposedly with renewable energy, which is not a very sensible way to do biofuels. There is a sensible way to do biofuels. I won't talk about it. So this chart is from 2007, when there was the first big surprise of Arctic ice melting in the summer. The red line there, this red line, is the median projection in the model. So, you know, you have to give the right wing credit for being right about one thing. When they are skeptical about the climate models, they are right. But they're not skeptical in the right way. Actually, the models are incomplete and imperfect, and the modelers will tell you that. But most of the things, or many of the things that are not in the models, actually would indicate a worse outcome, unfortunately. And so this, this thing was the measurement. So you see a sudden fallout. This is the threshold effect. This is your climate cliff. Now, instead of the median of complete summer melting being somewhere way out there in the 21st century where we don't necessarily want to think about it, it is now maybe 2015, next year, 2020, 2000, okay, we don't know, but it's much sooner probably. And now this is pretty widely acknowledged, which was not acknowledged by many at the time. So we've got a climate cliff to worry about more than a fiscal cliff. Okay, so nuclear, you know, all energy sources, you know, you produce solar panels, you're going to have some carbon dioxide pollution. You produce nuclear, you're going to have some. You produce wind turbines, you're going to have some. In an economy where you have coal, you're going to have some carbon pollution from anything. But if you get rid of the fossil fuels, you know, nuclear is a low CO2 source of energy. So is solar and so is wind. We're not lacking low CO2 sources of energy. We're lacking time and we're lacking money. And nuclear is bad for both. So I'll tell you a little story from Texas. In 2000, and so we've had this too cheap to meter and then a hangover from the too cheap to meter, which is really a come on story. Not quite, I'll sell you the Brooklyn Bridge. But at least if you bought the Brooklyn Bridge, the bridge is there. There've been more than 100 nuclear power plants that the public paid for that never got finished, that never generated any electricity. Now, in Texas, they announced that the South Texas two new reactors would be $6-7 billion. Two reactors, $6-7 billion. And so some groups hired me to say, well, what do you think the cost is going to be? And I said, I think it's going to be between 12 and 17 billion, and I had a press conference about it in front of City Hall, and the utility, which is a municipal utility, wouldn't tell us at the time what they were willing to pay for their 50% share. And then slowly the truth started creeping out, and they said 13 billion, and then, you know, already it was a scandal, and I was looking very golden there. 13 billion was well within my range. And then it turns out there'd been a little bit of a kind of, did somebody say cover up? Anyway, there'd been some attempt to hide the actual price. And then they said 18 billion. Now the project, I think, is pretty much dead, close to dead. There's not going to be a nuclear renaissance, fortunately, I believe. The cost is at the center of it. So $7,000 to $10,000 a kilowatt. The GE CEO, Jeffrey Immelt, said in 2007 that if he were the CEO of a utility, he was asking for nuclear subsidies. Now, he makes nuclear, he makes gas turbines, he makes wind turbines, that he would do wind and or gas. He would not do nuclear. So, you know, part of the nuclear enterprise is to be takers and to go to the government and say, give me money, and then I'll do nuclear. And very often they can't, then even then they can't do it. Or they go to the ratepayers, or both. He said it's a bet the company risk. Progress Energy has a project in Florida whose current cost estimate is $24 billion for two reactors. That's about, you know, over $10,000 a kilowatt. Or thereabouts, it's upper end of that range. And they're collecting money from ratepayers. I don't think they're ever gonna build it, but they're not obligated to give back the money if they don't build it. That's the law in Florida. Now, the CEO of Exelon said, you know, gas basically, to paraphrase that, natural gas is gonna kill nuclear. No price on carbon. So besides cost, what is the problem with nuclear? My fingers are too thick. These are centrifuges. That's the kind of plant in Iran that is causing global concerns about proliferation. But we built one in New Mexico. Did you know that a centrifuge uranium enrichment plant was started in New Mexico in the last few years? Many of us here tried to stop it. But we did not succeed. We would have to build two to three plants like this every year, somewhere in the world, if we tried to solve even part of the global CO2 issue with nuclear. That's, of course, Kristen already showed you the plutonium button. This is a different picture of the same thing. You make 90,000 bombs worth of plutonium in nuclear reactors every year. If you tried to solve maybe 40, 50% of the electricity generation problem to displace coal with nuclear. Not a very good, listen, all a nuclear reactor is, it's a boiler. It doesn't do anything high tech. It just boils water. We're making plutonium to just to boil water. Some people might say, duh. Okay, now you can boil a lot of water in one tank with not much uranium, but we're still making plutonium just to boil water. And if that is the limit of our technological innovation, we have to call on extraterritorial powers to help us. And then there's the proliferation connection. The creators of the nuclear enterprise knew this. Oppenheimer said that he would hide the nuclear weapons enterprise in a nuclear power enterprise if he had to go for a nuclear weapons convention, because other people may cheat, you know. I think Native Americans know very well that the United States never cheats and on treaties. And the Saudi foreign minister made a very interesting statement in 2006 in which he said, what, me, bombs? No, really, it's we have a problem with Israel having bombs, and we have a problem with Iran that may have bombs. We're going to do it in the open, and we're not going to. But we call on Israel to renounce nuclear weapons, and but we're going to build nuclear reactors, even though we have a lot of oil, and we have more solar energy than we could know. And he didn't say that. El Baradei also said that the rush to nuclear power is a lot about getting de facto deterrence. Okay. So these are, you've heard, you're going to hear a lot about the various waste problems. I won't go into it. I want to say a word about France, because everybody said, we have to be like France. They do 75% nuclear. And they extract the plutonium for recycling. And some people even say that they reuse 90 to 95%. That statement is wrong. It only contains, the French only reuse about 1% of their spent fuel. And they have a surplus stock of plutonium sitting there at La Hague on the Normandy Peninsula. Worldwide, we have enough surplus plutonium. We have enough surplus, it's the same amount of surplus plutonium in the civilian sector as there is in all the nuclear weapons, in all the nuclear weapon states put together. Mainly Russia and the United States, of course. The French have polluted the oceans all the way to the Arctic from their reprocessing. The British, of course, you know, they pollute the English Channel and the British pollute the Irish Sea, so it's all okay. And now I have to tell you, this is, I'm not anti-French. I'm very pro-French. I love the French. I sleep with one of them every day. The same one. I love French food. I love French trains. Their health system is very wonderful. We could learn a lesson or two. But this, they did under duress, and they really, right now, they're worrying after Fukushima, what if we have that here? What's going to happen to the Bordeaux? What's going to happen to the wonderful cheese? What's going to happen to our great gastronomic traditions? And it's a beautiful country. Those of you who haven't been there should go. Let's see, what happened here? Oh, how did I get rid of that? Okay, this was Fukushima before, this is Fukushima after, I won't dwell on this. The reason to show you Fukushima, the one point I want to make, is in the last few years it's become very clear, you know, you hear nuclear is baseload and that's why we should do it. But nuclear is baseload until it's not. It's 24/7 until it's 0 over 365. So now Japan's 53 out of 54 reactors are shut. So they are nuclear 0 over 365. It doesn't matter why they are shut. It's a technology that, for a host of reasons, more than a handful, can go overnight in an unpredictable way, so you can have an accident, it'll blow up on you. Of course, that one's done. But then all the other ones were done too. Now, that won't happen to a natural gas-fired power plant or a solar. You know, we had a wind turbine blow off a blade somewhere in the Midwest last year. The most catastrophic thing that can happen to a wind turbine. And fortunately, these things are a little bit out, isolated, nobody got hurt or killed. And that was it. 1.5 megawatts gone, which is, you know, a little more than 1 in 1 million. We have 1 million megawatts of power in the U.S. electricity grid. So 1.5 megawatts, nobody noticed it. Nobody died. It was a little bit of economic damage. And all the other wind turbines didn't get shut down. We didn't say, oh, well, you know, we're worried that all the other, you know, we're going to have wind turbine blades raining down on us, and so we shut them all down. We didn't do that. That happens with nuclear power plants. Well, Germany, you know, decided to accelerate their nuclear phase out. So 8 were shut down over there. We've got, you know, several nuclear power plants shut down over here for various reasons. We had an earthquake in Virginia last year, and that shut down for a couple of months suddenly. So it can go, this thing is not, I must be doing something wrong. You'll hear tomorrow about how the costs of solar have evolved, but solar, I think, is already on a large scale, kilowatt for kilowatt cheaper. It's intermittent, so it's not directly comparable. But baseload wind plus storage, is cheaper and less risky, or at best at the cheapest end of nuclear costs that are projected, comparable to nuclear. And baseload wind is a term that, you know, not, I didn't invent. Baseload wind is something that the National Renewable Energy Lab talks about. So let's talk about making plutonium to boil water isn't sensible. Using a lot of water to make electricity is not sensible to the place where we're headed. So we should try to get out of the thermal mode, which means we should try mainly to get out of coal and nuclear. To have a more secure grid, we also need a distributed grid. But the first thing we need is efficiency. So this is your average house, nearly 60,000 BTU per square foot. This is Hanover House in New Hampshire. Not fancy, not expensive, but well built. Thoughtfully built. So the most important thoughtful thing you need to do when you build a house is to know where south is in the Northern Hemisphere. And then you build it tight. This thing has no solar photovoltaic panels. It has solar thermal water heaters and a very large tank. It's heated by solar thermal heat and has efficient appliances and has only 15% of the energy footprint of a normal house. Same in the commercial sector. This is all very economical. This house costs in today's dollars about $150 a square foot to build, and it's got lots of custom features because it was built by the guy that cared a lot about where he lived. Now, why don't we have houses that are built normally that are this efficient? This building actually could use efficiency improvements. University of Chicago, please. Seriously, revamp your heating system. Thank you. And I'm not one to complain easily, but please. I give you free consulting advice. If you pay my way, I'll come and spend a day. Anyway, builders don't build efficient houses because there's no percentage in it for them. It has to be regulated. Apologies to Milton Friedman. Because they're selling you the beautiful azaleas, they're selling you the beautiful windows, they're selling you the granite counters, out of which you could get radon, but most people don't know that. And you go in, you know, how did I buy the house I live in? You know, we walked in, there was light, it was a beautiful kitchen, it was the kind of house, you know, there was space to arrange and put all the members of the family that we hoped to accommodate in there, and we loved it. And we said, yeah, that one. And then we found it was very inefficient, and we were spending a lot of time, you know, fixing it up. The builder's selling you that. Yeah, I really want this place. This is where. And that's the way it should be. You want to buy a house or rent a house that's a living space for you for how you want to live. It should come efficient. For that, in order to level the playing field, so regulations are about leveling the playing field for the public sector or the private sector. We need appliance and building regulations, and I will show you why. So this is the potential for appliance efficiency in the residential sector calculated by the American Physical Society. And you can see this is a few years old, so there's a little bit obsolete cost. Now it's about 10 or 11 cents. Of residential electricity, all these things are a lot cheaper. The average cost of doing all of these things together, the most expensive ones and the cheapest ones, is about right there. So one third the cost of, why aren't we doing this? Is because the market won't give this to us by ourselves. And the reason we actually have efficient appliances are because we do have regulations, and I'll show you. So this is what happened in the last 30, 40 years since the first energy crisis. Three appliances, gas furnaces, the black arrows are national standards and state standards. So state standards went into effect. Now, what is the political message anybody gets from this chart? Is there a political message here? There is a technical message, obviously. Anybody know what that is? Sorry? You need standards. No, that's the economic message. What's the political message? Okay, so you have to look at the color of the arrows. States came first. The federal government is a follower, right? So that's the lesson of U.S. history that this immigrant has to give you, is the U.S. government is the follower. In good and bad things, states come first. So make sure the state where you live is first in the good things and not in the bad things. So I'll talk about refrigerators. So this is the history of refrigerator standards. When I first started working on energy, not in 1947, the 1970 there, I started working on energy about then. Refrigerators were 100 kilowatt hours per cubic foot per year. And you can see this is the cost of refrigerators Let's see, which one is it? This is the cost of refrigerator. The cost, a frost-free refrigerator cost about that much. So you can see the efficiency went up. So now the energy consumption is only 20 to 25% of what it was back then. 75% of the energy consumption is gone. And I actually wrote a letter to Milton Friedman asking him to comment on my review of his book, Capitalism and Freedom. Maybe his heirs here, in the intellectual heirs in the university, will do that. If I find out who that is, I'll send it to them. But he did not respond to me. He sent me a letter saying he wasn't interested. You can see that with regulations, not only we got more efficiency, it became cheaper. Thank you. So government is always present in the marketplace. You know, government makes the money that is the blood of the capitalist economy, or any complex economy. All right, this is, so between Germany and the Pentagon, we may actually get somewhere. So this is a solar panel in a Navy base that was built in 2000. This dates from 2002. This would be sufficient for 250 houses of the Hanover House efficiency. So if you build houses to that efficiency, but that one doesn't have air conditioning. So that's a little bit... So not quite 250, maybe 100, 150 houses. All right, so this is a sunshine on a bright day, but you know, days aren't always bright. So people tell me, so what are you going to do when the wind doesn't blow and the sun doesn't shine? Well, I know, before I finished my book, I knew that the wind doesn't always blow and the sun doesn't shine, and you may get, you know, nights that are very still. And of course, by definition, the sun doesn't shine at night. By definition, I know that. So this is the ideal insulation curve, but I haven't learned how to download so I have solar on my house, and I can track each panel all the time, every half hour, and I have to learn how to put that little movie into my slideshow. I haven't done that yet. But when cloud spot, you can lose most of your generation in a very short period of time. It's a problem that you have to deal with. Also, I won't go into, I'll illustrate this with pictures, but there are a dozen ways to deal with that problem. First of all, when you put wind and solar together, so very often you have wind at night, so you have a complementary situation. So this is one, so you might need energy storage. First of all, you don't need energy storage where we are today. Until you reach 20, 25%, where Germany is now, or where Denmark is now, Texas sort of approaching. Did you know Texas was the leader in renewable energy in the United States?
No.
Yes, it is. I like Texas. I do. I go there quite often. Actually, this little flash drive was given to me by Public Citizen of Texas. So I'm reusing it. Compressed air energy storage. They have one project that they are starting up in Palestine, Texas, that is due to go online in 2016. Well, you pump air into a cavern. You use, when you have excess wind energy that nobody wants, you pump it into an underground cavern. Now, this is known technology in the electricity sector and also known technology in the natural gas sector, because you may or may not know a lot of our natural gas is stored in underground caverns, you know, because you can only put so much in the pipeline and use goes up and down. And so in order to accommodate the ups and downs of uses of natural gas, you have storage caverns. So you can pump it at the efficient rate from the wells and then pump it and then withdraw it or store it, depending on the demand. And so you do the same with air. Then when you pump it out, you have a heater. You heat up the air. And some people are even trying to recover the heat that you get from compressing the air and putting it in the cavern. And then you generate electricity through a normal gas turbine, and you put it in the grid. So you get what is called baseload wind? Where is my baseload? My charts are not in order. So this is the National Renewable Energy Chart. I'm Indian, so you have to settle for some nonlinear. So this is baseload wind. So these yellow parts are where you're generating from storage, and these orange parts where you have excess that you're putting into storage, and these green parts is because we don't have a smart grid and where we have too much wind energy and we're wasting it, spilled wind energy. Okay. I'll talk about spilled energy in a little moment. So that's one storage method. Another storage method is, you know, so this is an excellent nuclear system. So the nuclear reactor is up there. It's free. It's a thermonuclear reactor, safely 93 million miles away, and is using technology that was actually made for a fission nuclear reactor at Oak Ridge in the 60s, for a thorium reactor, actually, molten salt reactor. And so you are storing heat in a molten salt, and then you extract heat from it. So this is a thermal generation system. But you can actually, if you do the power towers, this type of storage, you can actually store at high enough temperature that you don't need cooling water, and you can still get reasonable thermal efficiency. So you only need to clean your solar panels, solar mirrors. I only have 10 minutes left?
Okay.
Q&A. Huh?
Until Q&A.
Until Q&A. Okay. So this is one way to do storage. This is, so you can store wind energy. Did you know you can store wind energy in frozen meat? Here's what somebody thought of in Holland, I think. So we, you know, there are commercial food freezers. So the food is stored at a certain temperature. I don't know what it is in Fahrenheit. Probably, you know, minus 10 Celsius or something, below the freezing point of water. Well, when you have surplus wind, what if you store it at minus 11 or minus 12? So you can lower the temperature of your frozen meat or frozen peas if you're a vegetarian. And then when you don't have enough wind, you can just turn off your cold storage compressor because you don't, and let the temperature rise back to the normal cold storage. Of course, you have to make sure you're not destroying your meat and your peas in terms of the flavor and consistency. So there's a little bit of food research to be done in this storage system. But this is more straightforward cold storage, is with this air conditioner, which is now commercially available from a company called Ice Energy. This is courtesy of Ice Energy. I have no commercial interest in Ice Energy. And you make ice when the wind is blowing, and then, see, this is a house in Sacramento, an efficient house with a solar panel. So this is its normal, this is its, this blue, light blue line is the normal demand on the hot summer day in Sacramento. And then this is the modeled, if it had ice storage, you see the peak demand just goes away. So you store ice whenever the energy is available, and then at the peak of the day, you get air conditioning from the stored ice. So you can store energy in, you can store energy in your hot water heater by making a little bit hotter. You can store energy in heat in bricks for the winter. So you have, if you have electric heating, there are many, many ways to store energy that we already know. Many of them are quite economical. Today, in the United States, mostly we don't need to store renewable energy because we don't have enough of it, and the existing sort of hydropower and natural gas systems can manage this. Now, this company is not doing that well, but the batteries under that hood are quite interesting because they can charge and discharge a lot more times than what you will need over the life of a typical car, so you can use it together with the grid. And when we have, I say when, we have an electric car system, going from a fossil fuel centralized system to a decentralized distributed grid will become fairly simple because most of the cars are parked. most of the time. In fact, we only use about 5% cars about 5% of the time. And so when you go to the airport, at National Airport, I did see a Nissan Leaf plugged in over there. They have electric stations where you can plug in your car. Now, that car is going to be charged up pretty soon before the person comes back. And then National Airport could make a deal with a grid operator and that can charge and discharge that battery according to the needs of the grid. We have all this technology. In order to make, we're not that far from economical, sensible electric cars. Batteries are about a factor of 2 more expensive, and they are about the energy density, the amount of energy you can store in the battery needs to go up by a factor of 2. So together between cost and performance, we're about a factor of 4 away from the gasoline car. So I think gasoline cars will become obsolete in the same way that stones became obsolete. We'll have plenty of gasoline, we have plenty of stones, but we're no longer in the Stone Age. Okay, so this is your midlife crisis, also an electric car. Tesla now produces sedans for the high end. This actually performs better than a Lamborghini and was only 40% of the cost. So if you have about 100K to, you know, you can get this. I think they're no longer producing it. You probably get a used one. Okay, these are sodium sulfur batteries. They cost about twice as much for efficient economical storage as they should. Well, twice as much as compressed air energy storage, but then you don't need a cavern. This is sodium sulfur storage at a wind farm in Japan. So this Japanese technology, we're beginning to use it in the United States on a pilot scale. So I've already shown you that. This is the technical chart that corresponds to baseload wind. This is how the thermodynamics of it will work. We put it all together in 2 studies we've done, and we're starting a third, which will be more advanced and detailed and will have more milestones. But, you know, in carbon-free, nuclear-free, I kind of gave an overall roadmap and a concept and a cost estimate. And then people said, well, you haven't shown every hour of the year, 8,760 hours, what happens when the wind doesn't blow and the sun doesn't shine, all that. How much storage do you need? How much will it cost, et cetera, et cetera. So we did a renewable Utah study and a renewable Minnesota study in which we modeled. This is just 1 month, but we did this for every month. We got actual utility data for demand. How much are people using in the main utility in Minnesota and Utah? Not in the same study, different studies. And then we got actual renewable energy data from the National Renewable Energy Lab. We downloaded it. We got the solar energy data. We got the wind energy data. So all this, the yellow solar generation is a summer week. And the blue, I think, is wind generation. And so you can see this is the black line is the demand. That's how it goes over the course of a week. You know, daytime, nighttime, and so on. And this is your air conditioning and evening peak. You know, when you all come home, yeah, air conditioning, and then turn on the lights and the TV and start cooking and all that. And when you have surplus, you store, and this green is generation from storage. So one very interesting thing you can see is you can have very low renewable at night, so daytime is not necessarily when you run into a peak problem when you have a renewable system. You could run into it at night because you have no sun and you have very little wind and suddenly you're emptying out your storage. And you can see actually it happens at night more often in the summer than in the daytime. And so you're storing energy. This is a winter week in Utah. That was a summer week in Minnesota, so I'm showing you pieces of our 2 studies. But we showed it can be done. We calculated the amount of storage that would be needed. These are 100% renewable, well, a small supplement of natural gas that could easily be biogas. So this is a kind of a, then we figured out where a smart grid would fit in. So this is kind of a brute force renewable system, that you have enough renewables and enough storage to accommodate all demand at every time. How many of you know when the defrost cycle in your refrigerator comes on? I don't know. It would be a really smart person if you knew, a well-instrumented fridge. So, okay, so nobody knows. Do you care? Okay. So suppose the defrost cycle in your refrigerator came on when we had an excess of wind. Or you set your dishwasher, so their dishwasher came on, unless you were right after a party and you had really a lot of dishes. The dishwasher came on when there was an excess of renewable energy and your storage was full. Or your clothes washing machine. And you had a smarter sort of thermostat and that could adjust 1 degree up and down instead of all completely on or completely off. You could make a much cheaper system. So if you do a brute force system, you see there's a very large part of your system, about 20%+, that you're only using for 77 hours in the year, less than 1% of the time. Very expensive. And another large part that you're only using, you know, 225 hours in the year, about 3% of the time, something like that. So you see, that's the cost of the most expensive. What we use at home is $100 a megawatt hour. So 50 times more expensive, that last piece. We can get rid of that by simply lending our defrost cycle and most of our clothes washing, like going to a smart grid. Now, are there privacy concerns with a smart grid? Yes, sort of. If you care that the utility knows when your defrost cycle is going, I would recommend that we have, or you might care more if they know when you turn on your dishwasher or not. We can have demand aggregator to obscure when people's dishwashers come on. We know how to do this. All the technology is here. Hurricane Sandy has shown us. I'll close with this one example. You know, on March 11th, before the nuclear disaster, there was a tsunami. And the tsunami actually caused an enormous, enormous amount of damage. It wiped out the port of Sendai, which was the closest large city to the earthquake, which was offshore. And it wiped out the transmission and infrastructure, the electrical infrastructure in the port, and of course, everything went dark, even that the parts that weren't flooded, except for one place. The Tohoku Fukushi University did not go dark. The Tohoku Fukushi University had a microgrid consisting of a natural gas generator, solar photovoltaics, and storage that was operating with the grid in normal times, and then when the tsunami came, it disconnected itself from the grid, and the essentials, the elevators, the lighting, there was a hospital, a nursing facility, the nursing laboratory, the essential equipment kept operating. Can you imagine how different the situation in South Manhattan would have been if we had microgrids? How much less disruption there would have been if we had... We know how to do this. Tomorrow you will hear that the Germans have become the can-do country. They're doing it. Do we have the guts? So what is lacking is not the technology. What is lacking is not whether it's economically feasible, because with climate, we're spending more and more money to protect ourselves from emergencies. The bill in New York and New Jersey is going to be very high, and that will have to be done all along the Atlantic coast and all along the Gulf coast. It's going to have to be done, otherwise we're going to have this more most likely. Every few years, we're going to see one of these things. We're having 100-year storms every few years. And I showed you that Arctic ice melt chart. Maybe I should say one thing more about why that chart is important. The sea level isn't going to rise because the Arctic ice is melting. It's just floating ice in the ocean. But the ocean becomes hotter, and Greenland becomes hotter. So that whole area is going to become hotter. The Arctic area is getting warmer much, much faster than the average of the planet. And the Greenland ice is the important part. I understand there's a film about chasing ice. I haven't seen it yet, but I am going to. That's the part we have to worry about. And lots of other things that were kind of beginning to assess. Nobody thought about the disruption of families as a result of a nuclear accident. But now we have to think about that. Similarly about climate, we're going to have to protect ourselves. Microgrids, smart grid, renewables can protect us against catastrophe, minimize the damage, but can also help minimize those things because we're also getting rid of carbon dioxide pollution at the same time. I think what is going on in the country right now with people who are for the environment and for more economic and social and environmental justice, insisting that we not have a socially, economically, and environmentally unjust system, at least in a minimal way that we should rectify the problems accumulated in the last 30 years. I think we can bring that same kind of force to give. I told you, states are first, people are first, even corporations many times, not all, but many corporations are ahead of Washington. The Pentagon is ahead of most of Washington because they know they're wasting lives and treasure by transporting oil to battlefields. We need to get some real guts and spine into energy policy in this country. 5 years after my book was finished, I thought at the time that it would take us 40 years to get it done. I think if we really had the guts, we can do it in 25 years. We can have a completely renewable energy system that will be more reliable, and I'm saying this today, I didn't say it then, than the current system, more resilient to disaster, and certainly more environmentally friendly and more responsible to our children. Let me close in Chicago, where the first nuclear reaction happened. Let me close with a personal thought. I've often said, you know, that I don't think I would have had more moral wisdom than Einstein were I here in 1939. You know, Einstein wrote the letter to Roosevelt, or signed the letter to Roosevelt that started the whole thing going. But I have also said that I hope that I would have had the moral courage that Joe Rotblat had in December 1944, when it was clear the Germans didn't have an effective bomb project, and he said, my job is done. That was before the first plutonium was separated. Before the first plutonium was separated. The chain reaction had happened here, but the first plutonium had not yet been separated at Hanford. There were microscopic amounts for experimentation that had happened, you know, at Oak Ridge and so on. But no bomb project plutonium had been separated by early December 1944. That's when this enterprise should have stopped. You know, some people in this university, to their credit, actually did try to prevent the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But I think when I have Einstein eventually reflecting on it, said it was the biggest mistake in his life, signing that letter. Leo Szilard also, I think, regretted it, the inventor of the concept of the chain reaction. You know, the Manhattan Project is often put forward as a project of brilliance. You know, if you have a problem in society, people often say, we should have a Manhattan Project for energy. I'm not so hot for a Manhattan Project. We've already seen that, been there, done. Brilliance is not enough. So the big lesson of the nuclear age is brilliance without a moral anchor can be a very big problem, a bigger problem than no brilliance at all. Thank you.
Thank you, Arjun.